Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week.
This will show up really good on radio.
We're walking into a small corner room on Port Miami. It's windowless and the walls are pitch black. We leave behind the din of a large open workspace for the relative quiet of this room.
Underneath of the virtual reality simulator.
That's Richard Fain. He's the chairman and CEO of Royal Caribbean Cruises. The small room we're in is in the corner of the cruise company's new innovation lab at its headquarters on Port Miami. It's the company's effort to harness more technology in everything from designing massive ocean liners to the layout of counter space in women's bathrooms. This room is essentially a three-story rectangle set on its end, and right now we're on the first floor.
The underground, one for above, and then all the way around. This is what's underneath the virtual reality simulator.
Two stories above us is where the virtual reality simulator does its thing. Right now, we can see the floor above us. The light projected from the simulator we're standing next to creates shadows of the footprints of people standing in the simulator on the floor above.
When we started this project, which was only a year ago, the projector was double that size, and it included air cooling and water cooling to keep it at the right temperature. It is a, most home projectors are 4,000 or 5,000 lumens. This is a 45,000 lumen projector because you need that kind of power to light up the floor. It's also 4K, so that's ultra high definition, so that when you do see the virtual reality, you can see it and it feels very real to you. I often go in there and people will reach out and try and touch something. It's kind of cool. The hardest thing in designing, especially a ship, is to understand all the spaces. And traditionally we've looked at it in pieces of paper, and that tends to mean you design one deck, and then you design another, and then you put a stairway in between. And what the ability to look at things in three dimensions does for you is it allows you to understand spaciousness. Does this feel gracious or is it crowded?
Now, Royal Caribbean's technology investments are guided toward making it stick out in a crowded cruising market. Big cruise companies like Royal Caribbean and Carnival are turning to technology more and more to step up their passengers' onboard experiences, make boarding the ship more efficient, and even design the ships themselves. That's what Royal Caribbean has done with its new Edge class of ships it announced last week. It will be the first new class for the company in more than a decade. Now, we'll hear more about them later on in this program. The cruise business overall is booming. Profits at Royal Caribbean were up more than 20% last year thanks to record bookings, and the company says this year began at a better pace than a year ago and with higher ticket prices. Its two Miami-based competitors also reported record profits last year, Carnival Corporation and Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings. And in the race to attract more and new cruise customers, technology is increasingly playing an important role. After leaving the first floor of the Innovation Lab, we made our way to the second floor.
So this is a prototype of us using an artificial intelligence to make the guest stay better. And so it's waiting just sort of like Siri would, asking how...
Joey Hasty is the head of innovation and transformation at Royal Caribbean. He came to the company from Disney. He has an iPhone running an app that a cruise passenger could use to look for activities, order a drink, and make dinner reservations.
It's smarter over time with what it serves up for you here. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to be predictive as much as it can. So in this demo, I'll ask for dining reservations. The app knows that
this technology will be rolled out this summer and installed in about 20% of Royal Caribbean's fleet by the end of this year. Half the fleet will have it by the end of next year. There's wayfinding technology it's experimenting with to help passengers navigate around the ship itself and even deliver a drink right to your hand without ever having to belly up to the bar. There's facial recognition software allowing the boarding of a ship without ever stopping to check in. Now, these types of technologies can have a direct connection to the business, getting passengers on board ships faster and making it easier for passengers to spend money on board. It's all important. About a third of Royal Caribbean's revenues come from onboard spending. But some of the innovations don't have such a direct profit motive. Take, for instance, X-ray vision. That's what Royal Caribbean CEO Richard Fain stopped to show us before we entered the main virtual reality simulator.
So before we go into the lab, one of the things you might be interested in is the doors are closed, I see. So I kind of like to know what's happening back there. and
you're pulling out your iPhone now.
Pulling out my iPhone, and I'm getting up my app. I just happen to have an app here that allows me to come over to the wall and look at the wall and see what's happening.
Oh, how about that?
And see what's happening inside.
You are literally seeing virtually through the wall, the drywall in front of you.
And I can see who's in there and what they're doing. It's a essentially, it's a live image.
You can see a meeting of sorts in there.
A smartphone app works with technology embedded in the wall, allowing a user to, quote, see through the wall. On the smartphone screen is a live image of what's behind the wall.
I think this X-ray vision stuff is really cool.
Now describe how you're going to harness that technology on board the ship.
Well, you know, it's funny you ask that because this is typical of something we do here. I don't know the answer to your question. We have found a technology, or people have found a technology, which allows us to literally look through walls in an exciting and different way. Now the question is, well, how do we use that? Like so many things, sometimes we start with ideas and then find practical uses for them. But in this case, for example, we can easily imagine people going behind the bridge, and they can't go onto the bridge for safety reasons, but it's fascinating to see what's taking place on the bridge. So they use our X-ray vision, and they can actually look and see what's happening on the bridge. They can do the same thing in the engine room, in the galleys. The other thing is, this is a form of augmented reality. And so one of the things they can do is they can go up to the art. Now, the art on board the ship is spectacular. And they can go up to the art and hold this X-ray up to the piece, and it will tell them something about the artist, what other work she's done, what modes of art, what materials they tend to work in. And so that flexibility, we can provide them more information. We can also provide them another possibility is that they can go to an area and say, well, what's going to be happening here in an hour? So the same technology that allows us to look through walls as a form of augmented reality would allow us to look into the future and say, here's what's going to happen here in an hour or two.
As a CEO, you get paid to look way into the future for your company, for your stakeholders and your shareholders. Is this kind of technology something that's proprietary to you?
No. One of the things that we've done is, you know, the pace of change is slower today than it'll ever be again. And we need to keep up with that. And you can't do it in a proprietary way. And so what we've done is, I think our skill has been in harnessing the technology that's there in ways that nobody thought of.
As you look to use this kind of technology, do you look to try to monetize this specific piece of technology? Do you look at each technological innovations as a monetization possibility?
No, if you try and do everything based on this is going to produce this much money, it never works. What does work is we are trying to provide an overall vacation of a caliber that our guests just aren't used to. And so providing X-ray views of the bridge, if that's what we end up doing, or providing this artwork that is of such a magnificent scale, it just adds to the ambiance of their experience. It'll make them feel more comfortable. They can see more of what's going on. They can understand. People want to understand their environment. So I think it will pay for itself, but it'll pay for itself in the bigger picture because people will take more celebrity cruises. People will pay more for those cruises rather than every single thing has to pay for itself. That's a very hard thing to do.
Just 6 months ago, where we were standing was a parking lot. Royal Caribbean built this 20,000 square foot space and attached it to its Port Miami headquarters. It won't disclose how much it has spent on it. The centerpiece is called The Cave. That's where the virtual reality projector does its magic, making 3D images, images of the company's newest class of ships designed entirely in three-dimensional. It was next on our tour with Royal Caribbean's CEO, Richard Fain. But first, you have to slip on what look like oversized flannel Crocs. You put them on right over your shoes. They are to protect the floor of the 3D simulator since it's essentially a screen.
Put my dancing shoes on. No left, no right, no all one size, right? All one size, no left, no right. Wonderful.
It's definitely one size.
It is, exactly. Could I borrow your glasses there? Wonderful, thank you.
There you go.
All right, I'm going to put my virtual glasses on here over my real glasses. And everything comes into focus here.
So, now I should warn you, I drive recklessly with this.
I'll put my seatbelt on, my virtual seatbelt.
And that always disconcerts some people. But let me just take you out like the seagulls will see. I'll take you out to the ocean.
Oh, there's the ship. I see it now.
And we'll turn around so I just orient you a little bit.
We are on the starboard side here.
We are indeed.
Yes, I see it. And we're looking at the starboard side of the ship as if we were a seagull.
Exactly.
Couple of seagulls.
Or wearing those jet boots. And we can come in close. This allows us to actually walk through the space and say, well, what would it feel like to be sitting here at the table while we're looking out? We're cantilevered out over the ocean. Right now, we're not at the top deck. We're on deck 14. So we're 14 stories up and get to look out over the sea. We can then say, let's walk onto the ship.
Virtual people are walking by us as we're walking through into the vessel on the pool deck here.
So here, we're sitting in one of the cabanas. We have these beautiful arches. We have this enormous space above us. So you have this opportunity to see what it's like. We can go around, and you can see the pool, a 25-yard swimming pool, which is unusual for a cruise ship. Those jacuzzis to look like martini glasses.
Mm-hmm. We're zipping through the pool deck into the solarium now. Here
sorry
it is.
Sorry to go so quickly.
There is a little motion sickness involved, I'll admit.
One of the advantages here is that you and I can be here, and one of our designers can be in London or New York or wherever, put on a pair of 3D goggles and see what we're seeing. And we can, for example, look at something and say, well, okay, let's see what this looks like if we change the colors or the lighting to nighttime version.
So almost a menu box just popped up in front of us virtually, and it's a selection of, do you want to see it during the daytime, sunshine, or nighttime? And here you just turned it to night. I can see the moon above us here, and obviously dark out the windows.
And it adjusts everything, including shades and everything else.
Talk to me about the computing power behind something like this.
It did require a massive investment in computing technology. It requires actually an even larger investment in the people to run it. When we walk in here, when I pick up the joystick and walk us around, it's very easy. But to enable us to do this, we have a cadre of people. We call this room the cave, and it's run by a person, Ephraim, whose title, official title, is Caveman. And he leads a team that actually oversees all this. And so the real work happens in preparing for this. It's no different than a dinner. You know, you serve a dinner, and the real trick of the dinner is the preparation. And it's the same thing here. The technology is the gee whiz kind of thing, and it is sexy as hell. But the real value comes from our people putting their heads together, not putting the atoms together.
And let me ask you about people, because the kinds of folks that an innovation lab like you've built take is different than a traditional type of recruitment of finance people, human resource people, customer service people. How have you been able to staff up that here in South Florida?
Well, actually, we've been very fortunate. We have really some of the very best people around. If you're in the design field and somebody shows you something like our innovation lab, that seals whatever deal is unsealed at that point. We are committed to making transformational change, not just a little better. And that's really what attracts them. It's the commitment. This happens to be, if you will, a symptom of that commitment.
And as you make that transformational change based here in Miami, with your deep experience here and the kinds of staff people that it's going to take to see through that transformational change, do you anticipate having a challenge drawing from the local workforce, or has the local workforce
changed as the company's changed to be able to fit those new job demands?
Well, I think Miami really needs and has been successful in upping its game and doing a better job of attracting people. But that is still the biggest issue for any business today. And especially with the pace of change the way it is, no community can supply all of that. And so the steps that Miami is taking to make itself more attractive, and I would like to count the Innovation Lab as part of that, that is crucial for our success as a company, and that's crucial for our success as a community.
Still to come is our conversation with Royal Caribbean Cruises CEO Richard Fain continues, the $5 billion bet on the company's first new class of cruise ships in more than a decade.
Today, we're all looking at each other and say, can you believe we used to design ships without this?
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Today, we're talking with Royal Caribbean Cruises CEO Richard Fain. He's responsible for one of the largest employers in South Florida. Last week, the company's celebrity brand unveiled its first new class of ships in more than a decade. The Edge class gets its name from a new design technique for big ocean-going cruise liners, getting rid of the traditional open-air oceanside balconies and making that space part of the cabins. In other words, bringing the entire cabin to the water's edge. Helping Royal Caribbean make the structural and other design changes has been three-dimensional technology, like virtual reality. I spoke with CEO Fain, standing above a scale model of the top two decks of the Celebrity Edge at its Innovation Center on Port Miami.
We've all used 3D techniques in the past, so there's nothing novel about using some 3D. But in the past, it's been the exception. Every once in a while, you do something special in 3D. On this vessel, everything has been done with 3D, and that's given us an ability to do things that you couldn't do based on the old two-dimensional thinking. So one of the big changes is the way the resort deck is laid out. And historically, you did it in layers. As I say, you had a first level and another level, and then you build a stair in between. But when you can start to look at something in three dimensions, you can start to make it flow more organically from one area into another. And keeping how these planes work, even the architects who do nothing but this can't keep it all straight in their minds. It isn't until you actually see it and touch it and feel it. And so we use models, we use mock-ups, we use three-dimensional imagery, and ultimately we go into the virtual reality simulator. The other thing the virtual reality simulator does, and all these things do, is it democratizes the process. Because for most of this stuff, unless you've spent your life looking at blueprints, you can't understand it. But when we actually say you can walk into this space, you can walk around it, well, a dining room manager can do that. The hotel director can do that. A waiter can say that. A cabin steward can say, this is my experience, and this is too tight for me, or this is in the wrong direction. And it allows us to bring to bear their expertise, and nobody knows the shipping business like our people.
Was that done at an unprecedented scale for this class of ships, this Edge class that you're beginning to build?
Oh yeah, nobody has used 3D technology the way we have on Edge. Edge was really the forerunner. Now I think people will learn and people do more and more of it, but nobody has done 3D technology. We haven't done it, no one else has done it, and we've used it for literally everything.
Take me back to that moment of decision that was brought to you or brought to your team to say, sir, we don't have to go to the shipyards in Europe to design the ship.
Well, we still need to do it in conjunction with the shipyard, so there are still trips. But yes, that the advantage of having it here, we don't have to plan a trip to France the next month. We can walk over, we can see it today, we can sleep on it and look at it again tomorrow. And it wasn't a eureka moment. It was a little bit of that when we said, wow, this is really spectacular. But we have found generally that absolutes work very well. And when we went from let's use it where we need it to let's simply use it everywhere, It probably took a month of playing back and forth of what we might do. The decision to build this innovation lab, it's a huge investment, obviously. I think it grew on us. When we first mooted the idea, there was a fair amount of resistance. That seems like a lot of money to spend just to save a few airplane tickets. And today, we're all looking at each other and say, can you believe we used to design ships without this?
Talk to me about that month of back and forth, those considerations. What were the operational considerations that you and your team had? What were the real logistical considerations about moving away what had been decades worth of a successful practice for you and the entire industry about building a new generation of ocean-going vessels into a place to do it with digital bits and bytes and virtual reality?
Well, we've just seen how fast everything has been changing. And we realize that today the pace of change is slower than it will ever be again. And we've always had to run to catch up. And we simply came to the conclusion that we couldn't take this kind of time to try and go different places and see different things. And it was so important to get it right the first time that we needed the three-dimensionality to make it work. And it took a while to get there. I knew it was successful when even our CFO said, you know, that's a pretty good investment.
When you say you needed to make it work, what do you mean by that?
You know, the beauty of cruising is that we offer such wonderful experiences. But we wanted to take that to a new level. We were convinced that Edge should not only be a better ship than we've ever done before, than anybody's ever done before, but it needed to be transformational. And transformational is a big leap. And so how do you get there? And we said we need to get there because the demands are simply growing. And the old technology would get us the old ships. And so we really needed the visibility, the ability to collaborate, the ability to visualize what things were that this new capability would offer us.
Was there a business case to be made for this Edge class? It's your first new class of ships in more than a decade.
Well, the Edge class was viable financially. It was a good investment, even if it was just a progressive change. So we were happy with it. And in fact, when we started out, we were thinking it was simply going to be an incremental improvement, always a little bit better. But then we saw a couple of opportunities that came up to say, we don't have to settle for an incremental change. We can do something extraordinary here.
What were those moments?
Well, I think it was a couple of things. I think it was the visualization of the cabin. You can make a cabin which is 20 or 30% bigger than all the other competing staterooms. You can give people the expanse of a larger room, a larger bed, a larger bathroom. People really want bathrooms. But in my mind, most importantly, it gave us a connectivity to the sea. And we said, that is so powerful that that ought to be a theme for the vessel. And that's when we came up with the title Project Edge. And that concept of connectivity to the sea, first it was in the staterooms, that's what drove it, and then we said, well, how do we get that elsewhere? And for example, on the resort deck, in order to get it, you had to redefine how you looked at it, and you could only do that in three dimensions. And once you looked at it in three dimensions, you say, wait a second, I know how to build this in a way that will give us that connectivity. And then we said, but we want something that really epitomizes all that. And over a fair amount of time, that one probably took 6 months of just focusing on what became the Magic Carpet. And when we finally had the design for Magic Carpet, by the way, we didn't have a name for it, but somebody said, that's magic.
We're standing in front of a mock-up of the last two decks of what will be the first Edge vessel here, and there's a Magic Carpet, which isn't a carpet at all, actually, but it is this floating piece of deck, essentially, that can go up and down the vessel from the top deck down to, I believe, almost water's edge.
It does go down to water's edge. And so it fits in with the celebrity's pillars, one of which is destinations. And so this magic carpet, which is the size of a tennis court, rising from the water's edge up to deck 16.
What are the competitive pressures that led to this kind of innovation? To say, let's take a tennis court size piece of deck, but not put it on the ship. Let's cantilever it out over the water and make it go up and down.
Well, I think one of the nicest things of working with the team here is the greatest competition comes from within. It always comes from within. If you're reacting to competition from somebody else, it never gets you to the same place. It's a different kind of pressure. Nobody's ever even talked about a need for any of this stuff. But as you say, to stand there and to move something that weighs 90 tons up and down the side of a ship just to give people a little more connectivity to the ocean, why? Most people would say, why do it? And the team here says, why not do it?
Royal Caribbean Cruises CEO Richard Fain. Still to come, the booming business of cruising continues, well, cruising.
The United States and the Caribbean are going gangbusters. It's frankly rather surprising just how good the U.S. market continues to be. There seems to be a level of consumer confidence I haven't seen in a long time.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. We're talking about the cruise business today with the chairman and CEO at Royal Caribbean Cruises, Richard Fain. It's the parent company of six brands, including Royal Caribbean International and Celebrity Cruises. It's one of the largest private employers in South Florida with a payroll locally of over 3,000 people. The company, like cruising, has been on a tear. Over the past 4 years, its stock price has tripled, outpacing its local rivals, Carnival Corporation and Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings. While Royal Caribbean just announced a new line of ships, the first one won't be sailing until next year. But it's its most recent launch, the Harmony of the Seas, that's doing big business on a big scale. It's the world's largest cruise ship, and it's based at Port Everglades. In its 2016 annual report, the company said it is experiencing, quote, exceedingly strong demand for its newest ship. This is where we picked up our conversation with Royal Caribbean Cruises CEO Richard Fain.
You know, it's too bad it's radio because the smile on my face would really tell it all. The ship, the design of the vessel is simply extraordinary. It provides a level of choice for our guests. They can do almost anything they want. The crew that provide that service are, I'm just in awe of the men and women that do that every single day. And the ship just continues to confound, not just exceed, but confound our guests' expectations. And so people come back, they love it, they tell their brother-in-law about it, they tell their coworker, and I would describe the bookings as having continued to be delicious.
It certainly has helped fuel a lot of growth that the company's seen. Four consecutive years of year-over-year double-digit earnings per share growth, and you're anticipating a fifth year this calendar year, too. What's fueling that kind of profit growth for the firm?
Oversatisfying our guests and them coming back and bringing others with them. Opening new markets. Asia has been very powerful for us. I think in a few years you will see the middle class in China exceed the entire population of either the U.S. or of Europe. And we have established an outstanding reputation in that market. China is a market that relies more on brand than almost any other country you can think of. And we continue to win awards and are clearly the most preferred brand in China.
We've seen the capacity growth in China. In other words, the number of new ships and new berths begin to slow down some. Still wicked fast growth, no doubt about it. But you also identified a little bit softness in the anticipated demand in China at the close of the last calendar year. The Chinese economy certainly has slowed down from its wicked growth over the past decade. There's been some issues around government financing and state-run institutions. Do you sense that softness continuing into this year?
I think I would take issue with the term softness. What we experienced was we have had 40, 50% growth rates in China every single year. And last year, the market tried to absorb a 97% increase, and shockingly, it had trouble doing so.
It's almost double the amount of capacity for cruising than the year before.
In 1 year. And so I think if we had only grown at 60 or 70%, it would have been fine. But yes, that resulted in a little softness. That should be our biggest problem. Looking forward, the market continues to grow. I think most observers expect the Chinese market will, in due course, be the largest market in the world, that it will exceed the U.S. And I think we'll continue to work to maintain our lead in terms of consumer preference there.
And does that mean, obviously, new opportunities there, new ships, new investments? Is it a shift of investment priority away from more developed markets like the United States and the Caribbean?
No, it's the United States and the Caribbean are going gangbusters. It's frankly rather surprising just how good the U.S. market continues to be. There seems to be a level of consumer confidence I haven't seen in a long time. We're doing reasonably well in Europe. It's not booming the way China is or even the U.S. is, but it's definite significant improvements. If we didn't have those other two markets, we'd say it was quite good.
You're, in fact, shifting some of your vessels, which normally would go to Europe for the Mediterranean, to stay here in the United States, including Harmony of the Seas. Is that an outward expression of your confidence in the U.S. growth continuing?
It absolutely is. And it's, you know, it's a question of relative. They're all good markets, but we have the advantage that we can go where the greatest demand is. So we're a little bit spoiled for choice. And the U.S. market continues to do well, and we will continue to provide growth here as well as elsewhere.
A good chunk of your growth came from just the ability to sell more cruises. You had more cruises to sell because you're adding new ships to the roster. How long can that continue? Are you beginning to see, as you forecast out long term, many, many years, bumping up against the capacity that the market has for cruising demand?
Well, you know, it's interesting that the market has grown very strongly for a very long period of time, and nothing glows forever. But the industry started from such a low base, and still, for example, in the U.S. market, only about 3% of travel in the United States now is cruising travel. In the U.K., it's half that. On the continent, it's even lower, and in Asia, it's lower still. So I think clearly you get to a point where a market matures, but one of the indicia of a market maturing, for example, would be less first-timers. And our company alone is attracting 1.5 to 2 million first-timers a year. So these are markets that are still growing very quickly. And I think we will reach maturation, but I'm happy to say we're not there yet.
You've also held the line on operational expenses in a significant way, which has helped fuel that profit growth for you and your shareholders. Is there limits to that as you continue to add capacity, continue to grow, continue to invest in the technological advances that the new class of ships will represent when they hit the world seas?
Yes, our people have been very good at controlling costs and doing so in a way while at the same time improving our actual service levels. So I'm very reassured by the fact that last year we had the highest guest satisfaction in our company's history. And not unrelated to that, we also have the highest employee engagement that we've ever had. And I think I say the two are related because basically a happy employee means a happy guest. And again, you can't hold costs that long. Technology can help and actually helps not only control the cost, but oftentimes offer a better product. But again, I don't see that lasting forever. But right now, we continue to do very well.
For your U.S. workforce, we're in an environment of about 5% unemployment, very, very tight labor markets. Are you experiencing that on the payroll side?
I think the key to our business has always been the people. It's always been the men and women who do such an amazing job. I tell you, to be in the position to lead such an organization is a thrill to somebody like me. Fortunately, we continue to be able to attract people because our people are just simply so passionate that that's infectious and it does, and people want to be part of that. But we need to be competitive as well. And South Florida market is a difficult one.
Are you experiencing wage pressures?
Always.
And is that being able to be reflected in ticket price pressures as well? In other words, your ability to either maintain ticket prices, not to offer discounts, or in fact increase fares?
Well, fortunately, we continue to be able to increase our yields, and that's been the key to our success. Again, fortunately, the bottom line impact has been better than the cost pressures on the other side. But there's no question, there are cost pressures. The challenge to our people, which they have met to a beautiful level, is can they offset those cost pressures, not by cutting the product, but by doing things smarter?
The low interest rate environment that the world has been in since the Great Recession has also been beneficial to companies like you. You've been able to borrow a lot of money. Some of that you've reinvested in the company for stock buybacks, for instance. But you've also gone out and have plans to build a lot of new vessels. I think over $8.5 billion of committed long-term debt for new vessels that will lead to almost 30,000 berths from your firm alone over the next several years. That's a huge expansion of capacity, isn't it?
It is, and it's a reflection of the strength of the market and the strength of the brands, I think. Ship orders now have to be made further out in order to just get the capacity. But the brands have established themselves so well as the preferred supplier, and therefore able to attract the pricing that gets that. But we are a capital-intense business, very capital-intense. I don't like to think in terms of the numbers you just mentioned because they still scare me. And I think that's a good thing. I think we should run scared. It does tend to make you extra cautious. It does tend to bring out that extra little bit of effort on your part. The market continues to grow. Our reputation continues to expand in that market, and as long as we are providing the extraordinary vacations that we are, I think we will be able to continue to raise our prices enough to continue to build on our earnings.
Royal Caribbean Chairman and CEO Richard Fain. Now, still to come, the company is on the eve of launching a new cruise itinerary, this one to Cuba.
I'm finding that Cuba has helped all of our other cruises, and that's a much bigger impact on our bottom line than any small impact from the few sailings we go to Cuba.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. By this time in May, the number of cruise ship passengers visiting Cuba per day will more than double. Royal Caribbean Cruises, Royal Caribbean International, will be part of that huge increase in traffic to and from Cuba. It will be the sixth cruise company to offer Cuban itineraries when it launches its Cuba service from Port Miami next month. The company's Empress of the Seas and her 1,600 passenger capacity will make the trip. It will add trips between Tampa and Cuba in May. Royal Caribbean is entering Cuba at a time airlines are reducing their travel schedules between the U.S. and Cuba, and at a time of uncertainty regarding how the new Trump White House may approach Cuba after the normalization efforts by President Obama. Richard Fain, the Royal Caribbean Cruises CEO, acknowledges the historic nature and intrigue around Cuba, but for a major cruise company like his, Cuba is just a tiny piece of business.
Cuba, of course, is a marvelous market. People forget how big it is. I mean, the coastline of Cuba is longer than California. The people are marvelous, but the infrastructure is non-existent, and it is today a trivial part of our portfolio and is unlikely to be a significant part in the near future.
You're only using one vessel, about 1,600 berths from two places, from Port Miami and from Tampa. Any concerns with the Trump administration changing travel rules or changing any other kind of engagement with Cuba in the months ahead?
So clearly we will watch with interest. Our impression is that that's certainly not high on the list of the administration. But I think we have shown our ability to move as winds, the tides change, and be responsive to whatever change is going on.
Are you having to make any kind of capital investment in Cuba in order for the vessel to be able to be accepted there?
No.
None at all?
Nothing material. I think the it's more a question of making the investment to know what to do and how to provide services to our guests when they come. But our position there is so small that we just haven't felt a need to do much about it.
You're a big global company, $20 billion in market valuation, so one ship moving to Cuba or back and forth is going to be relatively small. But I do want to ask you that the capacity within the Cuban market is for cruising is expanding quite rapidly from this month to next month on into July and August. It'll more than double in terms of the capacity of U.S. cruise ships going into Cuba.
Yes, and I think there is a lot of pent-up demand. I think a lot of people are interested to see what's there. I actually think the impact of Cuba on us has been coming from a different angle.
What's that?
Well, everybody talks about the angle of going to Cuba. But what I think Cuba has done is it has raised the consciousness of the Caribbean as a destination. And so I'm finding that Cuba has helped all of our other cruises. And that's a much bigger impact on our bottom line than any small impact from the few sailings we go to Cuba with.
Walk me through how that works.
I think it's really just a question of raising people's awareness of the Caribbean as a destination. It's just the impact, and you know, you get to see what people see what's happening in Cuba. People think of it as sun and beautiful islands and beautiful people, and they extrapolate from that to the whole Caribbean region. I think that's been probably the biggest impact from a commercial point of view.
Another big mode of transportation to Cuba that caused a lot of attention initially were the airlines flying to Cuba. We've seen American, JetBlue, just recently Silver Airlines and Frontier reduce capacity. Could that happen in the cruising industry as you see more cruises beginning to pick up, only to experience that market and really begin to adjust to what the business model and what the demand looks like?
Sure. The same thing could happen in our industry. We have our ships float. We can take them wherever we want. So we can just tell the captain, instead of turning right when he gets close by, to turn left. And that's an obvious outcome. We are responsive to what our guests demand. And if our guests demand that we go to Cuba, and there's a demand for that, we will be in Cuba. If our guests say we'd really rather go to one of the other Caribbean destinations, of which there are many, including some of our own, then that's exactly where we will take them. And that's been the keystone of our business for 45 years, and I don't see that changing.
Royal Caribbean Cruises CEO Richard Fain. Now, the company's first Cuba cruise leaves Port Miami on April 19th. The itinerary includes a stop in Mexico before spending 10 hours in the port in Havana. The published fares start at just over $1,100. Still to come, where the competition will come from, challenging South Florida's title as the cruise capital of the world.
Asia is expected in the next 10 years to surpass the North American market in terms of the leading cruise market.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. In recent weeks, Royal Caribbean Cruises, the second largest cruise company headquartered in South Florida, has broken ground on a $250 million terminal at Port Miami and finalized a deal for upgrades to one of its terminals at Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale. These are just the latest investments cruise companies and local governments have been making to serve a record number of passengers passing through. Port Miami and Port Everglades combined to play host to more than 4 million cruise passengers last year. Jabeli Herrera covers the cruise industry for our partner, the Miami Herald.
There seems to be a return in focus to South Florida, Miami, and Port Everglades as really key ports for the cruise industry and for the Caribbean market, which continues to be the biggest market by a wide margin for the cruise lines in terms of deployment in that area. And so this makes it a very accessible port for them to go to that region.
We're seeing a lot of ships be redirected to South Florida.
That's right. MSC Cruises, which is based in Geneva, it's a Swiss line. They are really focusing on North America now. They're very big in Europe and in other parts of the world, but not so much North America. And they're going to start that that focus with Miami. So they're bringing two ships here year-round and another one that's going to be seasonal beginning next year through 2019. And that really sort of speaks to the importance of South Florida for the cruise lines, both North American lines as well as European lines.
Tell me about, though, the investments that are happening in the infrastructure. Can it continue to withstand the kind of demand that these cruise lines want to put on the ports that we see here in South Florida?
Yeah, so we have a very big investment infrastructure-wise, at least from Royal Caribbean. What we're seeing is a 200-some-odd million-dollar new terminal that's coming. It's going to be state-of-the-art, and it's a really big deal for Royal Caribbean because they haven't been able to bring their largest ships to Port Miami. They've had to go to Port Everglades, which built a terminal that could house its 6,000-plus ships. So now they are focusing on Port Miami, trying to bring that here, but also improving the infrastructure in Port Everglades. Also heard today that Carnival is in talks to build an eighth terminal in Port Miami, and that would fill the terminal up. So that's about as much as they can grow at this point.
As all these cruise companies will say, these are floating assets, and they will go to where the business is. And the business is growing stronger in Asia faster. It's from a much smaller base, of course. So where's the competition in the years ahead that Miami and Port Everglades really need to stay in front of?
And you just said it, Asia. Asia is expected in the next 10 years to surpass the North American market in terms of the leading cruise market. And so that's going to be interesting because they've been sending pretty considerable ships to the Asian market. Royal Caribbean sent one of their newer ships was sent directly to Asia. Norwegian is building a ship specifically for the Asian market. Carnival also has ships in Asia. So that market is going to be a contender with North America and directly with us here locally.
The Miami Herald's Jabeli Herrera. Wanda Miles is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks as always for listening this week.